Okay, so let me thank first of all the organizers for the kind invitation, especially Maren and Thorsten, with whom I have been in direct touch. Today, this is the first of a series of two seminars, and I'll focus on Casimir force, so the mechanical features of quantum vacuum, macroscopic quantum vacuum, trying to confront different geometries and results from different geometries. This is the global outline, so I'll not repeat the outline on Thursday. So in this first talk, I'll give a general introduction and motivations, and then a brief overview of the second generation experiments and the geometries to study the Casimir force and what is better from some point of view, drawbacks and so on. And then I report on some surprises that are still to be understood, which we have found in the last couple of years, and then some final remarks on this. The second talk, 2 days from now, will be about, again, introduction and motivation, will be about the dynamical Casimir effect, the generation of photons from vacuum, and I'll discuss a little bit two possible experimental ways to study these, and a little bit of quantum field theory in strong fields as an alternative. Then the second part, since I hope to get feedback in these 2 days from you, I'll go to overall conclusions of the two talks, open issue discussions, suggestions, and I'll have just one section of acknowledgement for all the entire collaboration. Most of the original part in these two seminars is contained in the thesis of Wu Yong and Kim, who was here a few weeks ago, and was defended more than 1 year ago. I have a copy, so feel free to browse or make copies, whatever you want. There are a lot of details that is impossible to deliver in a seminar, or even to write in a paper. And apart from a rapid communication we published a few months ago, there is a long paper related to this rapid communication. Again, feel free to make copies and ask me more details. Okay, so here this first part will be very general, a little bit historical and methodological, so people who are more interested to the technical details of the second part can switch off the readers and vice versa. Okay, but the issue is that everything started from these forces, molecular forces introduced by van der Waals, the first modern attempt to understand molecular binding. And then the London theory, where these phenomenological van der Waals forces are described in terms of quantum mechanical exchange, But in this London theory, retardation effects are neglected. Okay? And at short distances, many experiments confirm the London theory, in particular also colloidal suspensions. The first work of Casimir and Polder regards the possibility to include the retardation effects of the London theory into account, so relativistic effects due to the finite speed of light. And Casimir continued also to extend the theory for different geometries, from having just two atoms or two molecules. And then there was this insight from Niels Bohr about relating these apparently completely different field of colloidal suspension, molecular force, etc., with zero-point energy, the Heisenberg principle applied to quantum field theory, if you want. And this, from the, let's say, cultural point of view, has a strong appeal, because it goes in direction of studying the quantum counterpart of classical vacuum. And this has a long tradition, apart from developing an entire technology, like the classical vacuum technology, you know, that Torricelli, Otto von Guericke, Pascal Boyle, all this line of great scientists is inside this scientific direction. In particular, here is the demonstration of classical, the fact that you can pump out vacuum, create a classical vacuum, was performed in Magdeburg a few centuries ago. Can you pump out quantum vacuum? Can you have a quantum mechanical pump? Well, so far nobody has been able to do this, but the closest thing you can do, at least, is to manipulate vacuum and to change vacuum modes in such a way to give rise to effects of microscopic interest. On this nice slide, courtesy of Francesco Intravaia, you will see, for instance, that if you take two parallel plates and they are conducting, the virtual photons inside the cavity must fulfill conditions, boundary conditions, well-defined boundary conditions on the walls, on these two walls, and so there will be a density of states inside the cavity different from the one, very different from the one that you expect outside, where there are no constraints on the wavelengths. And in principle, you cannot even understand if, and obviously we know that photons exert a mechanical pressure, because from the point of view of electromagnetic theory, there is radiation pressure. So it turns out that although here you have less modes contributing, only the one, a stationary one, they have strong density of states in correspondence to this resonance, the net effect cannot be predicted a priori. Turns out there is a cancellation, there is a partial cancellation between the radiation pressures exerted from outside and inside, and everything can be written in terms, and I think you have seen many times this formula, in terms of a radiation pressure from virtual vacuum, which can be written in terms of a constant, I'll call Casimir's constant, divided by the fourth power of the distance between the two plates. This Casimir constant is not a fundamental constant, but it can be expressed in terms of fundamental constant, the Planck constant and speed of light. And just to give an example, if you have a distance between these two plates of 1 micrometer, and you have these two surfaces of order of 1 square centimeter, you will have about 130 nanonewtons, which correspond to a pressure of 10 microtor. It's a lot, actually. Okay, from the microscopic point of view, it's a lot of pressure, a lot of force. So at this point, it's important probably to do some remarks. The first thing is that Casimir forces, or Casimir effects in general, are both quantum and relativistic. Okay? They can be seen as the relativistic counterpart of the London forces. In any case, what you expect is that both H bar and C appears in all the proper Casimir formula. So, from this point of view, sometimes it is a little bit of a stretch to indicate that the Casimir forces are relevant to nanotechnology, because in general, in the nano 10-100 nanometer range, the relativistic effects don't play any role. Now, second comment is that this is a convenient way, this vacuum field approach is a convenient and elegant interpretation, appealing as I mentioned before, but it's not essential. You can also work just with the sources, I mean, imagine these fluctuators in correspondence of the surface of the two walls, for instance, and everything is also working fine. Moreover, you can take into account easily, in this case, deviation from the ideal case of a conductor, and the finite temperature effects. This is the approach pioneered by Lifshitz, and there is all a school of philosophy, if you want, also the approach of Schwinger with the source theory is another example. And in modern field theory, if you like, there is always this confrontation between attributing effect of fluctuations to sources or to the fields themselves. Okay? So you can just work with the ordinary quantum field theory or to work with this Schwinger or Lifshitz kind of philosophy. The third is that many times it's mentioned that the Casimir force is small. This is not true at all in the nano world. It's nanonewton is a lot. Okay, if you speak to people working in atomic force microscopy, nanonewton is a large force. The Casimir force is difficult to detect for other reasons. For instance, because it's difficult to determine the distance between two macroscopic objects with enough precision, or in case of parallel plates, because it's difficult to parallelize the plates, but not because the Casimir force is small itself. Also, another remark is that if your interest is to demonstrate quantum virtual vacuum, there are many other ways which are more effective than Casimir forces to detect, to demonstrate with high precision that virtual effects in vacuum are there. For instance, lamp shift in hydrogen, or the G-2 of the electron and muon, or this, for instance, has an accuracy with theory of 1 part in 10 to the 11 or 12 these days. And at a more profound level, when you consider the electroweak unification with a large electron-positron collider, they have checked at 0.1% radiative correction. So we know that the virtual particles are giving rise to effects, and these effects can be better detected here. So after this rather depressing list of remarks, to a certain extent, you may ask why I am spending parts of my research talks in Casimir forces and Casimir physics in general since basically 15 years. Well, basically I have not changed a lot my opinions about the field, and it's enough to read this final sentence of this the first paper I wrote with Giovanni Carugno when we started to think of the possibility to detect the Casimir force using the equivalent of a scanning tunneling microscope. And there are two reasons, for me at least, to study Casimir forces. The first is that if you study Casimir forces in the micrometer range, you can at the same time study gravitational forces in the same range of distance. And the one is expecting that the Casimir force in that case should be a well-controllable background to gravitational forces or relatives of Casimir gravitational forces. Then the second reason is that vacuum these days is, quantum vacuum is considered as a sort of heater, if you want. Don't use this word because the first time was not successful, the classical heater, but in any case, there should be also dissipative effects in vacuum. So, for instance, in this case, we were thinking to use loss dissipation mechanical resonators to see vacuum effect induced dissipation effect. Now, considering this, if you want to study, let's say, gravitational physics in this range or this novel kind of quantum friction, you have to perform experiments, okay, rather than demonstrations. And let me take a few minutes to see a little bit the big picture of what I define experiments versus demonstration, because if we understand these, many other things later on will appear kind of clear. I'll start with demonstration because this is what we studied the first days when we joined any department of physics in any university. When in the lab we were supposed to do demonstration. Okay, the demonstration in general means that you go in a lab and you test that a specific model works. And in general, there is the model or the theory. It's not that you have to disentangle between many theories or you don't have any theory at all. The goal in general, apart from passing the exam in the university, but when you do a demonstration in a real research lab, the goal is to implement some model in the lab to demonstrate that something can be done. Okay? This can be useful. You can enable some technology, and if you don't succeed, failure is really a failure. I mean, if you try to demonstrate that you can fly with something which has a higher density than air, and this thing doesn't fly, that is a failure, period. And it's very difficult that you get into controversies with the demonstration. And if you repeat the demonstration in general, it's because you want to repeat, implement the result in other contexts or elsewhere. Okay? And here I give some examples, and this is a demonstration of the fact that with the laws of fluid dynamics, you can fly with something heavier than air, more dense than air. Lasers is a demonstration of stimulated emission, and an example for the foreseeable future, quantum computers. Experiments are, even if you are the same in the lab, are kind of different. Experiments means that you want to interrogate nature in general in a novel regime of parameter space. Okay, so there is a kind of frontier. It can be high energy, it can be low temperature, it can be whatever you like. But often the difference between experiment and demonstration is that there are no models, especially if you are looking at something not expected, or there are many models, not just one, the model. And in an experiment, even if you consider a failure to detect an effect, you can learn a lot. And especially, you learn a lot from surprises. Obviously, this doesn't have to be driven by by any technological agenda necessarily. And just because you are comparing many models and so on, very often this leads to controversies and has to be reproduced necessarily to be confirmed independently in other labs. Not because you want to implement the technology in another lab, but just because you want to be sure that since experiments are different, difficult, that you don't have any artifacts or something which is not reproducible. Yeah, I give here two examples. From this special relativity started, it was a failure actually from the point of view of detecting and demonstrating the existence of quantum of ether. This was a failure for Millikan because he didn't trust Einstein's theory of photoelectric effects, but in an experiment you learn a lot anyway, so they were not a failure from this point of view. And whatever will be the result from Large Hadron Collider, for instance, will be not a failure, because if we see the X particle, we will confirm what we know about the standard model, otherwise we will learn something new. So there is this big difference. If you don't, after 10 years of work on quantum computers, if in the next 20 years you don't come out with a quantum computer, it's really bad. Okay? So there is this difference, and sorry if, to talk about this, but sometimes we forget about the difference between these two things. And now, in our specific case, there are modifications, many models, there are expected modifications to the Newton's gravitational law, and pretty much there are a lot of models, obviously, but many reasonable unification of gravity to the other forces contains some Yukawa-like component which is adding to the gravitational field. It's a relative gravitational field, but the only difference is that it has a different strength. If you make unity the intensity of a gravitational field, it has a strength of order alpha here. And also, instead of being long range like gravitation, it has a short range, like any Yukawa-like kind of field. Okay. Now, before in 1981, so you can parameterize everything, in other words, through these two parameters, alpha and lambda. What we know from the experiment about possible value of alpha and lambda? Well, we know that alpha cannot be larger than some value, and lambda for a given lambda. Okay? This is just looking and reanalyzing the experiments already existing. This work was done in 1986. There was a proposal by Ephraim Fischbach and collaborators to reanalyze the old experiments of Etbosch concerning the equivalence principle, because this could be connected with the idea that there is a baryonic field. If there is a baryonic field coupled to the number of baryons, there should be a small deviation from the equivalence principle, so they reanalyze the data. It turns out this was called fifth force. There was a lot of excitement at that time. Was it a failure? The answer is no, because thanks to this reanalysis, even if there are no evidence for this fifth force, people made a lot of progress in our ignorance about Yukawa-like components. So what you see here with these darker green regions, and then also these red regions here added in 2003, these are plots kindly given by Serge Reynaud in Paris, you see that you gained a lot of knowledge about the absence of Yukawa-like component in these two regions here. However, there are two regions which are particularly weak, vulnerable from this point of view. The first is the one in which lambda, the quantum wavelength of the hypothetical messengers of this force, or this kind of fifth force, is larger than 10 to the 16 meters, this long range. So there could be long range deviations in this here, still compatible with the current phenomenology, and that lambda smaller than a millimeter. In both cases, if there is a force with a coupling of order 1, with the same kind of intrinsic coupling like gravity, but with these Yukawa ranges, we would not notice from the current experiment. Okay? And now if we zoom in, this is another issue, I mean, I'll not talk about this, but in this case, if we zoom in this region, and we go in the range between centimeter downward to nanometers, like in this case, the most important background you have to disentangle for a possible force is due to vacancy force, or variation vacancy force if you are not using conductors like Casimir, Lifshitz forces for generic dielectrics. Okay? So apart from at larger distances, you can still use pretty much macroscopic torsional balances like in the original Ed-Bosch or Dickey-Braginsky experiments and so on. But at smaller distances, you have to use micro-resonators or even nano-resonators in this range. And apart from ultra-cold neutrons, it seems that there are no other alternative experiments to the use of mechanical structure which are vibrating, and in this case the Casimir force is expected to provide the biggest contribution for the background. Now, the Casimir force has been studied, apart from one exception, in two experimental configurations. And the reason for not studying directly the parallel plates is that it's difficult to parallelize two surfaces, and it's the problem of dust, at least if you don't use a superb technology in terms of very clean vacuum rooms, can be a problem. However, to keep in mind that if you have two parallel objects at a given distance, you'll get automatically, just because they use a parallel geometry, nanonewton range of signal in force. If you use instead a sphere plane where there is no issue by definition of parallelism, you also solve partly the dust issue, because unless you are very unlucky that there is some dust on the top, it's less likely that you'll end up with issues of dust. Okay? The drawback is that you have smaller signal. And although there has been in the last few years a lot of progress in the exact solution, especially in the cylindrical plane case, until a few years ago there was no straight sum of modes approach, while in this case there is a textbook kind of calculation for the ideal case of the ideal conductor and so on.
Something that you can be comfortable with the dust not an issue simply because of the curvature says it's unlikely to happen in the closest place?
This is a good question, in the sense that we'll see an example. I mean, if you have a radius of curvature which is almost flat, I mean, like centimeter range, like for instance in our case or Stieb-Lamoureux case, it can still be an issue. But yes, but if you use 200 micrometers, 100 micrometers, like most of the experiments using microspheres, it's very unlikely that you'll get some dust on the. Okay, so it's
So that's a statement on micrometer radii.
Yeah, in that case, yeah. And apart from Lamoureux and most recently us, all the other experiments are using 50 to 200 micrometers radius of curvature for their spheres.
What's the issue about hydrocarbon layers or water layers or whatever you can have on this?
In what sense? I mean, these spheres, for instance, the microspheres are coated with gold. Then you say on the top of the gold you can have, they can contribute. I mean, so far nobody has detected their effects apparently. And the other trick is to try to use as better vacuum as possible, oil-free pumps and all these details. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so this is more or less what they call the second generation of experiments, the first being the one pioneered by Sparnet or Van Brockland, Overbeck, etc. Van Brockland and Overbeck were the first to use the sphere plane geometry in alternative to Sparnet, who was the first to use a parallel plane. And pictures, yeah.
Were not the Russians the first to use it with sphere plate?
Yes, the Ryagin, you mean? But not in the metallic case. Yes. There is a lot of noble land still to be recognized, by the way, or at least acknowledged, between what I call here Casimir force between metallic surfaces and the equivalent force in the dielectric phase. But Abrikosova, Deryagin, and many people, I think even before Van Sparnet studied, in that case, there is an issue characterizing from the dielectric point of view the materials, which is complicating the analysis. However, it's much better to determine, for instance, the distance between the sphere and the plate, because you can use, since now you can see through the surface, you can use, for instance, you know, Newton rings and all kind of optical approaches to measure the gap. So, but this is just referring, I'm just limiting the attention to genuinely metallic surfaces, if possible. So this is a picture taken from the Steeb-LaMoureux experiments in Seattle, then with a torsional, you see a macroscopic torsional balance. So, on this plate there is a spherical lens with, I think, a radius of curvature order of 20 or 10 centimeters. Then this is the experiment in atomic force microscope of Umar Mohedin in Riverside. This is the only experiment done in a configuration which is not a parallel plate or a sphere plate, because it's a two-crossed cylinder. It has been performed by Thomas Edert in Stockholm. And so you have two surfaces like... it's not intentional, they were here already, but you take two cross cylinders like this, and you don't have any issue of parallelization, unlike this case here, and you can study. It was a very nice, I recommend to read this paper, because there are also methodological issues about fitting the data, measuring the distance, and so on. Then there were experiments performed always with the micro-resonators at Lucent Labs, in the group led by Federico Capasso, and at Indiana Purdue University by Riccardo Decca, both using sphere plane configuration. So they are more or less in the same family of the Umar Mohedin experiment, the difference being the detection system. I mean, the structure is similar, but they do use here a capacitance meter, and here they use a fiber optic interferometer. And this is the experiment we performed in Padua using parallel plates. So you can see, this is seen from the top, so this is a structure, a microscopic cantilever with the size, in this case, of the order of 1 centimeter. The height here is 2 centimeters. Is clamped here, as you see, and it is faced by a similar structure. So, we measure the signal with a fiber optic interferometer. This is not the fiber, obviously. It's just a cover, because a metallic cover. The fiber is tiny. It's a little bit spot, a very small spot inside. The reason being that this is a picture taken under a scanning electron microscope, and the electrons can create some undesired signal. They can charge the fiber and create a spurious signal on the resonator, attracting the resonator. Since I'm sure that pretty much all these configurations in one way or the other have been covered in the other experimental talk, in particular I think Andy King spoke about the modern version of distortional balance, the experiment going on in Yale. I think Umar Mohedin spoke about the status of his experiment in Riverside, and likewise, I think Jeremy Monday and Riccardo Decca spoke about the progress. So let me just focus on this, which has not been represented, although I strongly recommend also to give a look to this very nice physical UA by Thomas Edert. So the parallel plate configuration, the project started in 94. We succeeded to measure in June 2001. It's using a fiber optic interferometer. It's everything is under vacuum of a scanning electron microscope. The surfaces were kind of microscopic, as you see, 1.2 times 1.2 millimeters. At the end, we didn't use 1 centimeter wide resonator just because of this dust issue. We preferred to sacrifice the signal and use 1.2. On this scale, 1.2 is something from here to here, so it's very tiny, because the chances to get dust on 1.2 millimeters is much lower than to have an entire 10 millimeters. Okay? And if you reach a smaller distance, since the signal depends on the fourth power distance, you win anyway in terms of signal. The explorer distances were between 0.5 and 3 millimeters. And this is a picture of the setup. This is, for instance, still the 1 centimeter resonator, cantilevers. As you see, there are inchworms and a system of piezoelectric for approaching, parallelization, and so on. These are the data of a residual frequency shift. We measure, as in many other cases you have seen, the signal is measured as a frequency shift on the frequency of the mode of a resonator, of a micro-resonator. So if there is, for instance, an attractive force, you will have a downshift proportional to the gradient of the force. And this is a fit with...
Sorry, what was the 0.5 to
3 millimeters?
I'm sorry.
It's you can just read here. It's the minimum approach point was half a micron. This is the last point from the sense of approaching as much as possible. And you see that the point at the highest distance was taken at...
Micrometers,
yeah. You see that most of this data here are pretty much compatible with zero signal. So most of this data instead have some value. I mean, and that is a fit with the fit power law. The fit power, because since you measure the gradient of the force and you have scaling with the fourth power of the distance, you gain an extra power in the distance, and so you get from this fit this value of what I called before Casimir constant, 1.22 plus or minus 0.18, versus what you expect from the first principle, which is 1.3. So this is...
Can I just ask a student question?
Yeah.
Why not plot on log paper? Because those points seem to be systematically to the left on one side, systematically to the right on the other side.
Yeah.
What would that show?
Here, in
the physics lab to plot on log paper.
Yeah, I mean, this is absolutely possible.
The data prefer a small exponent, isn't it? The data would prefer a small exponent.
Yes, they do prefer. If you interpret these as deviation, both systematic deviation, it seems that you have a best of exponent.
Right, so
yes. Some people.
What would you get for a power law?
This is an interesting question. I can maybe something, if you just try to do best fit, leaving the exponent as a free parameter, probably you'll get something less than 5. Yeah.
I'm just even wondering if it's a constant exponent.
Constant? Mm-hmm.
Well, the power itself is a function of distance.
Okay. So if in a log-log you get a straight line We can try. I mean, some people have interpreted this weaker signal as due to the first sign for conductivity corrections.
They got a guy on the left near 2000 and I drop him vertically.
Yeah.
That's a non-trivial difference from the line.
We have discussed this in the original paper. If you go in the caption of this figure, this is the fourth figure of a paper, which is this one here, by the way, we discuss and we also introduce a term, a drift linear term in the distance, which corresponds to a possible drift in time. And you get a better fit, actually, if you introduce also a drift which is linearly depending on time. We can discuss later, obviously, but I recommend to see the caption because there are details of the fitting with also we noticed also that there is this anomaly here. We were not so surprised here because you have to consider that the snapping point for the resonator is around, I think, 0.4 micrometer, meaning that if you approach 0.4 micrometer, the frequency shift becomes very large and you get zero frequency. In other words, they will stick to each other. Okay? So the last point at 0.5 micrometer was already taken near this kind of instability region where the deformation to the parabolic curve for the harmonic oscillator induced by the signal of the Casimir force is already very strong. So we were not surprised. You see also the error bars of the fit are larger than...
Yeah, but I mean the last three or four points are systematically to the...
Yeah. Well, I should... especially these 3 points here. More than these, I mean, this is not a big deviation if you see on the vertical. These are pretty much fitting. Anyway,
these... Do you determine the distance?
Well, the distance is determined, as in many other experiments, with an electrostatic calibration. So before this final measurement, you determine the distance applying intentionally an external voltage. and measuring the frequency shift depending on this distance, and from this you get the strength of the signal. Okay, and you know already what is the strength of electrostatic signal scaling with the distance. So, but I'd like to postpone, since this is a critical point I'm going to touch in a few slides in connection with the latest measurement, I'd like to postpone to go more in depth on this later. Now, one of the issues, if you want to do experiments and to understand the possible existence of Yukawa-like components superimposed to the Casimir force, and you are working the few micrometer range, one of the corrections you have to take into account to the Casimir force, the bare Casimir force, without any, just in the idealized case, is the fact that in this gap, whatever gap you consider between a sphere and a plane or two parallel plates, the gap is also filled at, unless you do an experiment at very at the low temperature, is also in any case, in that case, but it's reduced with black body radiation. Okay, and photons are undistinguishable. Virtual photons and real photons will give rise to the same radiation pressure effect. So you have to take into account the thermal corrections also, at, especially if you are working at distances large enough. For instance, around 500 micrometers, thermal correction can be already of the order of 10% or few. Between few and 10% of the total signal. And if you want to control the Casimir force to subtract from the real signal to look for residuals or relate this to possible Yukawa-like forces, you must master this part here. Now, the problem is the following. This experiment took many years, okay, because of all this issue of polarization, dust, and so on. The bypass of this is to use a sphere plane configuration. However, the sphere plane configuration has a smaller signal in absolute value, picometers instead of nanometers, as I was mentioning, and also the scaling, yes, basically this is the main issue of the sphere plane from this point of view. Now, a compromise, a reasonable compromise, is to use something between a plane and a sphere plane, so to use a cylinder plane geometry. So you gain with respect to the parallel plate configuration because it has less parallelism and dust issues. Okay, because you have to take care of parallelism only in this direction, not in two directions. So nothing is going to change in this direction. You have just a one-dimensional issue of parallelization. Obviously, you have less signal with respect to the parallel plates at the same distance. With respect to the sphere plane, it has still an issue of parallelization not present in the sphere plane, but more signal. And this shares also the possible issue, at least when we started this idea, of the proximity force approximation, because in this paper we figured out what is the signal expected on the basis of PFA, the proximity force approximation, and we also discussed the experimental problems connected with this possible geometry and demonstrated some first feasibility study of this in this configuration. I have to mention, and one has sooner or later to do a relation between the two, that thermal effects have been already measured in the case of Casimir polder in bosons and condensate. This is an experiment performed by a collaboration between a theory group in Trento, led by Pitajeski and Stringari, and people at Gila, led by Rick Cornell, and they do see it's not exactly what I'm talking about, but is relative, okay? And we are still to understand how they are related to each other. If from this physics and what we get, we can say something about the corrections in the case of a Casimir. This was done in particular with the kind of non-equilibrium situation, so it's not exactly mappable, but it would be nice to understand more the relationship between the thermal effect on the Casimir polder force and the thermal effect in the Casimir force itself. And so in the PFA, the cylinder plane force is scaling like this. So it depends on distance with a fraction response, which is in between what you expect you have in the PFA for the sphere plane force, 3, and what you know from the exact theory in the case of parallel plane. So it's 3.5. It scales, it is extensive with the distance, with the length of the cylinders. It scales with the square root of the radius. Okay, so it's not so bad if you use, with respect, you don't gain linearly in using larger radius. You just gain with the square root. And obviously, since it's a casting force, you expect h bar c, like in all these other cases, with a proper combination of pi and other little numbers. Okay. So if you calculate, for instance, for two different models, you see that here you need an experiment because you have at least two models. It's not going to be a demonstration. You have two models. They are controversial. They are fighting each other since many years. They make predictions. There is a plasma model which takes into account also the fundamental T0 mode. In this one, there is no contribution from this particular mode. And the prediction of these two models are dramatically different when you reach 3-4 micrometers. This is true for all geometries. And here the plot is the force, casting force, with the conductivity and temperature taken into account, corrections, normalized to the casting force with a very infinitely conducting material and zero temperature, versus the distance for different geometries. So in the case of a sphere plane, you have a larger deviation. Then parallel plane, you see that the dependence is a little bit softer. Cylinder plane, it's in between. Since the plane is always in between these two geometries for one reason or the other. And if you have just two cylinders slightly eccentric to each other, so imagine these have the same diameter basically, but you put one cylinder inside the other, which is, a configuration like this, but not symmetric. If it's symmetric, obviously the force is zero, but you have slightly eccentric cylinders, then this is, you see, it's kind of immune to this correction. So if you want to use this for an experiment to look for gravitational force, probably the best thing to do is to use a slightly eccentric cylinder, because they are less more immune to these corrections. And these are the two different predictions for the two different models. As you see, they differ a lot in this range, because in this case you have a 50%, kind of 50% deviation, and here it's an order of 80% or something like that in the same range.
Did you say about the radius for this, of the plane, or this, of the cylinder, or
This is obviously for a particular. Yeah. Yes, I don't have a number here at hand. We can look together. I think that the radius of curvature for the sphere plane and cylinder plane was chosen the same, just to compare at least the two, obviously.
It's probably, say, much larger than microns.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So, I mean, in such a way that the PFA is reasonable, looks reasonable. Yes. And also because, if you use, look here, I mean, if you use, again, you have an issue of signal. What I'm plotting here is a ratio between the two. But you have to consider that they are scaling down, okay? So you want to have a reasonable absolute signal. Since they scale with the radius, you want, in any case, to have a radius large enough. This A is a radius in the case of cylinder, okay? So it's mappable to this radius of the sphere here.
Yeah, but see, the plasma wavelength used in this calculation?
It's for gold, the standard one for gold.
180.
Exactly.
Or 37.
No, 137, I think. We use it at least. Everything is in the paper. We can look together after. I don't have that paper with me, but we can look. And so in order to do this, you have, instead of using a spherical lens, you use a cylindrical lens, and you can use a configuration with these, the same kind of micro-resonators, and this is work going on at Dartmouth. So basically, it's very similar to the parallel plate case from the point of view of a detection system. You have an optical fiber, and this is a resonator, and this cylinder plane, gold-coated. The gold coating is of 220 nanometers with, in the case, this is already purchased with the gold coating. This one we make an evaporation, and it's preceded by 10 nanometers of chromium. And we can use an optical microscope for the assessment of a cylinder plane. So these are the, for people who are interested, everything is in the Kim thesis, if you are interested about the numbers, but just to give an order of magnitude, these resonators have as a fundamental mode at 800 hertz roughly, and the length is 2 centimeters. Thickness of a nanoresonator is order of 300. We also use the softer resonator, meaning with the less thickness, but they are much more fragile, by the way, so it's a little bit difficult. The mass of the resonator is of the order of 100, 200 milligrams, and the effective Calvin constant, I mean the stiffness that we estimate, is of the order of 5,000 newtons per meter. Okay? If people working in atomic force microscopy work with much less stiff resonator. So this means that in principle we don't have a lot of sensitivity with this resonator actually at a large distance, because they don't deflect a lot for a small force. And everything is under vacuum, and we use a fiber optic interferometer with an input of between 5 and 10 milliwatts and a laser at 770 nanometers. This is an example of resonant tube you get at the FFT spectrum. You can use both an open loop scheme, just sending the signal from the fiber optic directly to the Fourier transform spectrum analyzer, or in a second stage we use the closed loop scheme using a phase log loop, in which you do the same, but it's in a closed loop configuration, and you gain, it's like to gain about a factor 20 in the quality factor of a resonator. So you can have, instead of spending, let's say, half an hour to take an average on the FFT to get a reasonable curve like this, you'll get this in a few minutes. And from the point of view of a methodology to parallelize, we can rely on the fact that the capacitance of an object, of a cylinder in front of a plane, so the capacitance between cylinder and plane, pivoting, with the cylinder pivoting around the midpoint, is minimal when they are parallel. Okay? So just looking to the, if you have two piezoelectric which are moving back and forth the cylinder around the midpoint, around having this as a pivot point, and then looking to the capacitance, you can understand where is the optimal voltage for the piezoelectric actuators within the error bars, obviously, of the determination of this parabola, which is making a configuration as parallel as possible. In any event, even if you are, it's enough to be close, because then in principle you can do everything and put this as an extra parameter. This deviation from parallelization you can put as an extra parameter in the fit. But if you don't do this a little bit carefully, you don't approach small distances. So this is and this can be done, obviously, at the level of Coulomb law. So we just you can also use electrostatic forces in alternative to measure the capacitance. You use electrostatic calibration, changing the angle, this angle theta here, and optimizing the force in order to get the minimal force. That is, in principle.
What were those two coefficients? I didn't understand it.
Which coefficients?
5, 8, and 21.
Oh, these are just numbers coming from, if you use the PFA for, if you calculate the PFA, apply the proximity force approximation for non-parallel plate and cylinder in the electrostatic and the Casimir case, you get these two coefficients, which are one four times the others. I mean, it's just come out from the, but the the dependent simile is parabolic in this parameter, expansion parameter in the deviation from parameterization, okay, which contains the length of the cylinder, the distance, and the theta, the deviation from the ideal parallelized case of theta equals zero. So, in other words, this is a little bit more sensitive by a factor 4 to this deviation from parallelization. And the status now, the status is the following. I assume a little bit that since this is the last kind of experimental talk of this school, that you are familiar with this technique of the frequency shift, where you measure the free frequency of a resonator, then you approach something, and if there is a force which is not just a constant force but depends on the distance, you have a change in the frequency of the resonator. Okay? And you can calibrate this putting intentionally an external voltage. In addition to the external voltage, there can be always an internal voltage like contra volta potential and so on. So you can introduce this as a parameter in your fitting, etc. And if electrostatic forces alone are present, you expect a quadratic dependence on this V minus V naught. And in the case of a cylinder plane, you expect a dependence with an exponent which is 2.5. Okay? With the dependence of delta n squared on the distance. Now, what I'm plotting here is d naught minus dpzt, in the sense that what you do in you don't know the absolute distance of the gap. Okay, what you know is that there is you approach as much as possible, and that is your latest point. Then there will be something more. Okay, an extra, and this is an offset, and this is a parameter in your fitting. So when you take the data and you fit the data, this delta n squared will be fit versus, for instance, dvpzt, once you take into account the dependence on the... So the first thing is to extract a coefficient which already contains the dependence on v. This is called curvature, electrostatic curvature, let's call it. Then you plot versus dvpzt, and you determine this offset in the distance from this. Okay. Doing this, we have been able to reach order of 1.8 micrometers. And the possible limitations are the usual. There can be limited precision in parallelism, dust particles, resonance drift due to thermal and mechanical instabilities. Okay? Soon we are going to use cylindrical lenses with lateral width of 3 millimeters instead of a kind of 1.2 or 1 centimeter we were using. So again, this will reduce the issue of a dust particle. But in the meantime, we also found something a little bit strange, that if you plot different curves for different distances, and you determine this V naught from the fit, from the electrostatic fit, this is not going to be a constant value, but depends on the distance. So this, let's call, for a reason which will be clearer later, let's call this a minimizing potential. Okay? We found in the cylinder plane case that this minimizing potential, instead of being constant, depends on the distance, and is not even in a negligible way. As you see, it has seems to have a straight slope. So to clarify some issues, we started a dedicated campaign on measurements in the simpler situation, where we can get rid of a priori of some issues like, for instance, extra dust or parallelization. So we started to go back to the original sphere plane geometry. And we used spherical lenses with radius of curvature kind of microscopy, as you see, order of 3 centimeters. The diameter of the spherical lens is 8 millimeters. So it's in the same ballpark of a case of a Steve Lamoureux experiment performed in Seattle, but we can reach smaller gaps. That experiment, I think, explored until something like 600 nanometers, 1 micrometer, something like that, but not less than that. So if you repeat the electrostatic calibration in the sphere plane, you measure the proper frequency of the resonator, this will be given by, yeah, by the electrostatic contribution, okay? And this is what I was calling before electrostatic coefficient, the scaling with the square of a voltage subtracted a proper V0. Then there will be also the residuals, and this is a proper frequency. So a proper the measured frequency, square of the measured frequency will be the proper frequency squared minus these two contributions, and this can be also be, actually, this contribution can be negative, meaning that you will have an upshift if you have, for instance, a repulsive force. This procedure has been first outlined in a clear way in a paper by the Capasso group when he moved to Harvard. Basically, you apply a bias voltage, an external bias voltage, so you measure this frequency, you take a square, and this, then you have this nice parabola. As you see, as you get close, this how much you are close is given by this voltage here. So we apply here 30 volts to the piezoelectric actuator, which moves the sphere close to the resonator. So as you apply more voltage, you are approaching diminishing the distance. Okay, so 30 volts, you have this parabola here. 35 volts, you have you are closer, so the electrostatic force gets stronger, and this is manifested by the fact that you have a stronger curvature. Okay? So KL is stronger here. And then 40 volts, and notice that, okay, if you zoom in, you can determine V0 just looking to the peak of the parabola. Depending on the value of V0, V0 will be the point here for which you reach the maximum of the parabola. Also notice that they don't have the same origin. In particular, this one has a residual which is downshifting the frequency. So once subtracted the electrostatic contribution, there is a downshift here in this case. Okay? And this is a relationship you can introduce for this electrostatic coefficient depending on the square of the distance in the case of a sphere plane through the effective mass of the resonator and the radius of curvature of the sphere. And the distance is related to the voltage you have to apply, you are applying, this 30, 35, 40, 40, etc. And this is a fit of a curve, like also this one, a parameter of a curve. So the first surprise, in line with your question about the casting in a parallel plate, is that if we leave free the exponent, instead of holding the exponent at minus 2, you see here that in principle what you should do is, if you believe there is a total control of the electrostatic, you plug in the fitting a curve like this with the exponent minus 2, if you think that has to be in the numerator. And if you do this with minus 2, you get this blue dot line curve here. Okay? And these are the points. And if you leave free the coefficient, the exponent, you get a better, by one order of magnitude in the chi-square, reduced chi-square, a better fit. In pretty much, apart from this case here, in pretty much all the cases you get a better fit. In any case, you get a better fit than minus 2. Now, if you increase, if you have two functions, and in another one you have an extra parameter, in general you expect a better agreement. I mean, this is but the fact is that the reduced chi-square is dramatically diminished once you introduce this extra parameter in the fit. It's not just a smooth transition. So this is, let's call this the first anomaly.
I'm trying to get an intuition of the magnitude of the field between the plates under the conditions you're doing this. Am I allowed to take the voltage applied and divide by the gap width and get some idea of the fields?
Yes, you may.
These terms are fairly large fields, don't they?
You have an order of one, for instance. Well, we should see if you have a distance.
That blue guy over there, yeah.
Yes, so you have an order of one, for instance. In this case, we applied the first notice that the range is not the same. So when you are at the large distance, you apply 16 volts span. when these are the voltage of the actuator, not the voltage you apply. Electric field, the external electric field you apply is spanning in this case between minus 8 and plus 8 volts. Right. In the case when you approach very close, is between here and here. So we adapt the step of the voltage to the particular distance in order to get more or less the same frequency shift. Frequency shifts are order of half 1 hertz at most. Okay, we don't want to apply because then you introduce a lot of non-linearities if you introduce very strong field.
If I have a capacitor, what kind of field is it, and then is it a nice capacitor?
So
the distance is so small, surfaces are a little rough. I just don't know how to think about the fields here.
Well, I mean, again, the voltage are chosen to have a targeted kind of, a standard 1 hertz of, because otherwise we are kind of comparing different worlds, okay? If we were going to apply minus 8 and plus 8 volts, when we were much closer, we were in a completely different, we could also sneak the two surfaces. So this is a first issue. Keep in mind, however, that this resonator is very stiff. So it's very rigid, and in principle, if you apply a large voltage, you are no longer speaking about the same gap when in comparison when you are applying a small voltage, because if you have a higher voltage, there will be a smaller distance. In this case, these 5 kilonewtons per meter of stiffness are such that you have less than. I think 0.1 order of angstrom or sub-angstrom deflection when you apply fields like this. In any case, we also tried to see if a frequency shift depends on the span we apply. So we can, obviously, if you use a small span, you get a small frequency shift, and so your signal-to-noise ratio will deteriorate. But obviously, if you use too much, you have the opposite problem you're pointing out. This seems to be a kind of optimal region. I mean, to target the voltage in such a way that you have order of 1 hertz frequency shift. Okay? Other questions? Okay, so this is the first anomaly we found, but the second anomaly we also found is that this minimizing potential, unfortunately, is not clear here. Okay, if you zoom in this region, you will find that this maximum here occurs at a different abscission than this maximum here. But if you do properly and you see the numbers, the minimizing potential versus voltage PCT. So as increase the voltage of actuator, it means that I'm approaching smaller and smaller gaps, depends on the distance, at least in two cases, this case here and this case here. Here, these two cases here, you see here there is when you have very large distances, you have larger error bars, but then you have consistently this kind of, seems to be a slope, it's a steep slope. Here it's less steep. Here you have something which seems to be constant. I'll present the opposite. If you want, you can convert, knowing the actuation coefficient of the piezoelectric, you can convert these into distances. For the first anomaly, let's say, we also did some statistical tests. I mean, in this sense, let's see how much the fit is sensitive in the case of the optimized exponent. By the way, the optimized exponent turned out to be softer, so it's order of 1.7, 1.8 instead of 2. Okay, so the softer exponent, as you see, is more in agreement with the experimental point, so it doesn't go quickly, doesn't lower quickly with the distance. This is versus VPCT, so you have to imagine here you are almost at zero distance, and here you are increasing the distance. So here we did some tests, you can see in the Kim thesis and so on. You take a few points, the larger distance points, and you do a fit, and you get some parameters. And you can get some parameters both for the alpha and the offset voltage of a PCT, which is a PCT at which you will touch, the two surfaces will touch each other. And then you add an extra point, a closer point, and you repeat the fit. And you see how much is stable each of these two parameters. Turns out that in the case of this black curve is for a minus 2 exponent, the standard electrostatic, the coefficient depends a lot on how many points you are adding progressively. While in the case of a 1.7, or yes, I think in the run 1 case it was 1.7. These are 3-4 different runs we focused attention on because they had a lot of problems clear with respect to many other runs we had. But as you see, it's very stable. I mean, it doesn't depend on how many points you add up in the fit. Okay, this both for this parameter alpha, which is a coefficient in front of the delta n square, and for the determination of the distance. These are results of a lot of thoughts and discussion inside the collaboration, because the first signal that things were kind of wrong with this anomaly in some sense were that the effective mass was depending on how many points we were adding the fit. Okay? If you want, this alpha is proportional to the effective mass, and we were not consistently obtaining the same effective mass depending on the points we were putting into the fit. Now, here there is a list. We can go through the list. We can discuss also later on, and I can feedback on the Thursday on this if I have input from you, but study deflection on cantilever could induce some nonlinearities, as you were pointing out, but it's kind of very stiff, less than, as you see, 0.2 angstrom, the displacement introduced by the static electric field, typical static electric field. Now, thermal drifts can be an issue in principle, because this apparatus, if you compare the size of this apparatus, it's inside the vacuum chamber around the diameter of cylindrical vacuum chamber with a diameter of order of 20 centimeters. Again, there are pictures in the thesis you can see. It's more bulky than the typical AFM setup. So if you have gradients or temperature and so on, they can be more effective, and they are more effective than a typical AFM setup. However, we try to see this. You need really a ad hoc history for each run to take into account the effect, like a kind of monotonic linear drift, to take into account this anomaly. Non-linearity of the PCT, we have calibrated several times the entire range of measurement of the PCT with the fiber optic interferometer. We have measured, as you see, the from here, we have measured in different runs with different final voltages. You see that here the asymptotic value when you reach a voltage is occurring at around less than 50 volts. Here it's occurring at roughly 55 volts, 55 and so on. So the anomaly is always there, so it cannot depend. And also, if you measure the capacitance of this gap, I mean this sphere plane with the distance, with dependence on the distance, is kind of accurate, as I'll show in the next slide. So we don't think that the nonlinearity of PCTs are playing such a strong role on having deviation from minus 2 to minus 1.7. Nonlinear oscillation should induce peaks at higher harmonics at the Fourier transform at the spectrum analyzer. We have looked for that, not observed. You can think that there is a convolution, that the sphere actually comes not from a single radius of curvature, but is coming, for instance, from a given radius of curvature and then another radius of curvature here and so on and so that. Okay? So it can be a convolution. As far as they are all centered around this point, all these spheres, doesn't matter, because this means that you have an integral of different radii, but they all depend on the square. So this kind of deformation should not induce any deviation from the, at least in the exponent, from what you should observe for electrostatic calibration. For server roughness, the correction were calculated, evaluated to be given the roughness values of the two surfaces, negligible even the smaller gaps. And as, just to give you an example, you see these are the capacitance measurement with the AC bridge, and the window for possible nonlinearities versus the VPCT. So this is the entire scan. The maximum voltage for the PCT is 110 volts, so it's almost the entire scan. As you see, and we were measuring basically in this region, by the way, these are the windows for deviation from nonlinearity of the PCT. Or if you believe a PFA formula. In any case, the agreement with the proximity force approximation formula for the capacity and vessel distance is within 2.1%. Actually, it's more accurate than to determine the coefficient of the capacity and vessel distance plugging the numbers, the theoretical numbers, given the value, known value of the radius of curvature from the company. So, we can discuss a lot about what is going on, but I think that definitely larger radius of curvature are more susceptible to both the geometrical defects and also deviation from usual electrostatic. For instance, if you have patch effects, they can have a larger contribution than in the case of small fear. Then we went back to see if there are mentions of this issue in previous papers. Okay, and since the usual reason to publish a paper is just to communicate to other, or to give a talk is to communicate to other people your problems, scientific problems, I mean, then we wrote this rabbit communication, submitted I think half of April and published it then in August, and suggesting also to reanalyze data. Fitting them with the free exponent, for instance. So just then these I had some email exchange with some other of our colleagues in the field, and here it's I think it's worth to do a disclaimer. We don't claim in any way that previous experiments are wrong. I mean, an experiment is an experiment. You take data, data are there. You have in mind some interpretation, some theory when you analyze the data, and we just simply suggest to all the people in the field to reanalyze their data, keeping free as parameter the exponent in the electrostatic calibration, and check also that the minimizing potential depends on the distance or not. So far, apart from few plots I'll show now, immediately now, there's not been a lot of attention on these issues, and it's important to understand what is going on. Okay. The second anomaly.
The comment Andy Kim made during his talk here that we should reconsider the validity of Coulomb's law, and we were a little bit surprised to hear this, of course, but I'm hearing a little bit of that statement here. This reanalysis does seem to say that ordinary electrostatic thinking is not adequate. Is that correct?
Obviously, here now we are in the domain of personal opinion. Andy,
yeah.
Andy has noticed that I am still in touch with him on this issue. Has noticed that just that the Coulomb law has been tested directly with three experimental data by Augustin Coulomb 2 centuries ago or more. Okay. Now, consequences of deviations from, and he was pointing out that the usual experiment you see in the Jackson, the first page of Jackson, is affected by contact potential, etc. I think that there will be dramatic consequences these days from a deviation, even a slight deviation, because it means that we think that the minus 2 exponent in the Coulomb law is related to a photon mass, and we have very stringent limits. So my view in this, not Andy's view, is that we have if you measure the force, the electrostatic force between two molecules, you don't get the Coulomb law, right? Because there is a complexity of the van der Waals force, etc. So I attribute more of these deviations to the complexity of the surface. Each atom follows the Coulomb law, obviously, but if you have, this is discarded, for instance, but I'll give you in a second an example which was figured out in a recent comment to us, where, for instance, you can continue to believe in the Coulomb law like we all believe, and still get an anomalous exponent. Okay, so Andy has his view, and as far as one is also proposing an experiment, is thinking to an experiment to reanalyze the Coulomb law from directly from that point of view, there is nothing wrong with that. It's also to catch the attention. For instance, in this case, you are following since more than 1 hour, so it may be the same issue.
Following since I was an undergraduate at Dartmouth, actually, and I remember very clearly seeing those balls moving with a spring, and it was
So the second anomaly, this dependence on minimizing potential on the distance, apparently is shocking, but is less, if present, is less harmful, and seems to be more general, in the sense that it has been reproduced in other labs. Okay, obviously, now for this, to take care of the second anomaly, you have to assume that this phenomenon of an anomalous exponent is not universal, and otherwise I cannot have an idea of calibration. Calibration means that you have a demonstration of something you can rely on, like electrostatic force, and then move on to do something that is your target of physics and experiment. So I assume that the first anomaly is taken care of with some other. So if the minimizing potential is distance dependent, one can design a consistent strategy to measure the residual. And the starting point has been figured out by Steve Lamoureux a few months ago with a small but very effective remark on Los Alamos archive. And the idea is that obviously the electrostatic energy depends on the distance, not only on the capacitance in the case of the minimizing potential depending on distance, but also on the minimizing potential itself. So if you now you calculate electrostatic force as a gradient with respect to x, you'll get the usual term related to the gradient of the capacitance, and then an extra term which contains the dependence on the gradient of this V naught. Okay? So now, if in our case you do this machinery, you calculate the new force, electrostatic force, and you in our case we are sensitive to a frequency shift and so on, you get a differential equation which is relating the contact potential to the minimizing potential. In other words, minimizing potential, the potential which is minimizing the electrostatic force contribution from the external, from the application of an external voltage, is no longer what we call the contact potential, but there is this extra term which contains the dependence on the special dependence on the capacitance and the dependence of the contact potential itself. So this now is a differential equation where you know experimentally the minimizing potential and you want to get the contact potential. So you take the experimental point for the minimizing potential. This is run 1, for instance. These are in a log scale in the distance. These are the points. And then you see, in a linear log scale, they are kind of, seems almost a straight line. But actually, you can parameterize these, and nobody has a clue why it should be like that, with a logarithmic dependence or an exponential dependence. Okay? Lamoureux prefers a logarithmic dependence. We have also tested what happens with the exponential dependence. Then you plug in, you parameterize this dependence on the distance with the fitting equation curve coming from this data for these two hypotheses, and you get the contact potential, which in the two cases is represented here. So the good news is that is not so dependent on the distance like in the case of a minimizing potential. It's a softer dependence. And then once you know this, your measured square frequency will be the proper frequency of resonator minus all the physics plus drifts you have from everything else. The usual electrostatic contribution coming from the application of an external voltage, and the new electrostatic contribution, which is just due, if you want, to the internal voltage, the contact potential. Okay? So you subtract also this term here. These are the measured value of the frequency, of the square frequency here. Then you subtract that term with the hypothesis logarithmic fit or exponential fit, and you get these dashed lines. And the expectation for a Lipschitz theory are these dotted lines here. I don't consider this a determination of the Gaussian force, because by the way we were able to parameterize only in one runs out of four in this nice way the minimized potential. In the other case, you don't have any meaningful convergence to a known law.
What's the meaning of the error bars graph.
This one?
Yeah. Should we take them seriously as error bars or not?
These are the errors on the determination of frequency is really order of millions, is really minute. But this is the error bars coming from the fit, this parabolic fit. When you have these parabolic fits in the that I presented here, yes, here, you have as parameters. As three parameters in this parabolic fit, you have this one and the not also. And the parameters are coming with their error bars with one sigma standard deviation error. Okay.
I was asking sort of an easier question. Error bars usually cover the lines that they fit, or there's some, you see a bunch of lines, bunch of points out of the line. It's supposed to mean something if your measurement means something.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not clear what that is.
Well, how many points within two sigma are out of a fit? For instance, let's suppose to take the logarithmic fit. These within two sigmas, I think maybe I'm wrong, but my claim is that within two sigmas, apart from this point here, all the points are fitting these, are within the dashed black dashed line.
The random scatter that analysis would work, but you're having a whole bunch of them on one side.
These are cluster mode on this side. These are cluster mode on the downside, and here is more kind of random scattering. I agree.
So the way I learned was to ask myself how many times I toss a coin and get.
No. You're absolutely right. I mean, it's a. But I don't have any clue for a reason for which it should be logarithmic in the first place. I'm just suggesting a way to take care of this second anomaly from the if there is this dependence on the distance. Somebody?
Now the horizontal axis is voltage, right? Converted distance.
The right?
The horizontal axis distance is really voltage, isn't
it? Yeah, really? Is
voltage.
No, this is an absolute distance. We converted the voltage of a PCT into.
But then shouldn't there be some horizontal errors also?
Yeah, but that is kind of negligible on this scale. It's really the actuator. I mean, you have an error on the PCT, which is really small. Then you have also the error on the actuator coefficient, which is determined with something like 2% error. I think 87 plus or minus 2 nanometers, nanometers per volt. Yeah. So it's really you don't see this in this scale. Apart from the fact that here is used the log scale, but the error bar in the horizontal is really.
I'm more concerned about the comparison with the Lipschitz curve, which is coming later. Whether or not the Lipschitz curve, if I were to shift it a little bit to the right or to the left, it would, how much freedom do I have in that?
Yeah, I agree that there can be and there is can be a you can move by a relative error the distance. The absolute distance is not determined with we can see the data on the paper, but the absolute distance is more a critical issue. What you should trust at the percent level is to move from this point to the other point and the reflected error on that. Okay, but the absolute distance is anyway. This is as I mentioned here. It's a methodology to get around this issue. And now the. If you want to reanalyze the things in the light of this effect, you ask your colleagues and to see if there is a similar effect found. And these are our data, okay? Minimizing voltage versus distance. So in January this year, I asked kindly the data to Federico Capasso and Obu Chan for their original experiment in Lucent. So I took their parabola, I fitted, and I determined V naught. And you see that it's you don't have to say anything in that case. There is a tiny effect. You see, you go from a distance here of the order of 100 nanometers or less, you have a central value around 244 millivolts for a minimizing potential, and then you don't need to fit with a straight line. It's going, let's say, 3 millivolts, almost 3 millivolts higher when you are approaching 2 micrometers almost. Okay? So there is a slight dependence on the voltage, of a minimizing voltage on the distance. I was acting as an external reviewer of a PhD thesis in France last year, I think in September 2007, and there is also over there a plot in the thesis of Guillaume Jourdan. Georges Chevrier is his supervisor. So I asked the data, and this is the plot. So you see that V naught versus distance is very large at large gaps. Then here you can claim that it's starting to flatten out, but you never know. In any case, even if at large distance it's difficult to determine V naught with enough precision, you see that you have a larger error bar, so there is a significant dependence on the distance. Then also Riccardo Decca sent me kindly the data for one of his runs, and here you see there is not a linear trend or any monotonic trend, but it seems to be all scattered. I mean, if you believe the error bars, you cannot assume this as a constant value. You can say that this is dependent on the distance in a kind of a scattered way. Okay?
But this is several runs, right? This must be several runs.
No, at least I...
Just one?
Yeah, I mean, this is what I got there from.
Sounds strange because you have several data points at the... With the same distance, this must be several runs.
Maybe that he repeated the, you mean, in the same run he repeated the measurement many times at different, at the same point. I can ask details, I mean, but in any case, this, as you see, within the error bars is not.
Would be then not the correct thing just to add a systematic error and take that as a systematic error with the spread?
But again, this is not what has been done in the previous analysis. Yes, obviously, you should, for instance, take each particular point and subtract that particular point. What it has been done so far is to take the average, for instance, in all cases, and I don't know in this case if they took the part where it was, or they took probably each point individually, but in this case I know for certain that they took the average value of this. And obviously this means that considering the huge scattering and the fact that you have these kind of small error bars, that you have systematic effects.
You got just a couple of millivolts, 3 millivolts, right? I mean, in comparison to other, well, okay.
Well, but a couple of millivolts on 15, right? So it's actually among these is a strong, more effective because it's order of 10%. With respect to the absolute value. Here it's you have a span of 3 millivolts on almost 2 micrometers, 3 millivolts out of 244. So the effect is less than percent. And here it's larger. The only way, I mean, you can claim that it's a constant value if you increase the error bars. But then, again, propagating the errors, if you declare a larger error bars, you have to propagate the errors then in determination. That is also going to affect the analysis. One way or the other, all these experiments are showing that we should be more careful in analyzing this issue of the minimizing potential. There is also another plot I found in the literature. There is a very nice paper by a Riverside group of Omar Moedin, in which you will find a lot of very careful analysis appeared as a result of the proceedings of the Leipzig conference appeared this spring. And you'll see also over there a plot where there is V0, minimizing potential, versus the separation distance. Now, don't look, this red part is what I have, red ticks and red line, what I have added, okay? So the original plot is all black. So what I have done in absence of other evidences is just to add the ticks manually as much as possible parallel to this one. And then draw a horizontal line starting from the midpoint of the nearest point and parallel line. What is your impression? Is constant or there is a trend? It seems that most of the points are above, and in my opinion, these points are roughly twice with respect to this one up. So I do see here a mild straight line. It's unfortunately, as you see, although the phenomenon is compressed in a range of, let's say, 10 millivolts, the scale is kind of coarse, so you cannot have. But if you, I try to magnify with zero copies and so on, the effect of the order of 3-4 millivolts. So again, is percent effect, 1% effect. Okay, so you have difference between this point at 400 nanometers and 50 nanometers is of the order of 1% difference in the minimizing potential, which in proportion is even higher. It's similar, it still seems to suggest a straight line, but it's a stronger effect than the one at the Lucent, because this is a percent, but in a range which is larger. So in terms of slope, the effect seems to be a little bit larger. In this case, the difference from the other is that he is studying the sphere plate, where the sphere is gold plate, gold coated, and the plate is a semiconductor. Okay, so it's even in the case of a conductor, semiconductor surface, there is a kind effect of this. If you want to read their paper, they claim that the average V0 was determined to be this value here. They claim that this V0 is a constant. Okay, it's a relative constant average value of V0 as a function of separation. I mean, relative constant average is a little bit oxymoron, but the point is that the value of V0 is assumed to be constant and equal to the average value. One should obviously do a best fit with a linear function with a given slope and compare to the best fit with a constant value and compare the reduced chi-square, etc. So even in this case, the effect either has been unnoticed or neglected, but in any case, the aerostatic force seems that has been calculated compensating with the constant value equal to the average among these values here. The same group recently, maybe you are aware, has posted a very nice comment on our anomalies, and the idea is that what is going on is a little bit in line with what I was mentioning before. It's not a deformation or deviation from the fundamental law of electrostatics, but it's just due to the complication of the geometry. For instance, they suggested that you have a background curvature like this, and then a small bump like this with a very tiny but enough in an ingenious way to reproduce this exponent 1.7. Now, unfortunately, this is a possible explanation. It's given as an example. It's just a warning to say, look, I mean, there can be a problem of the complexity of the surface for this large radius of curvature. This particular kind of example is strongly constrained by the fact that the measurement of a capacitance versus distance seems to agree with what you expect from electrostatics. Okay, and that is performed with an AC capacitance bridge. Then, if you look at the FM, there is nothing strange, at least like this. Also, in some of the runs, we were tilting. We have a capability to tilt a little bit the sphere with respect to the plane, and the same occurs. I mean, if you have a tilting, this structure is going to affect less or more. So it's obviously I cannot go more in detail because this is a comment going on. It was, the procedure for the comments. It was sent first to us. We accepted in one day, and hopefully will be published soon together with our reply. If you are really curious, I have also a reply here. It was written for three or four days after we read the comment, and we can discuss privately. But obviously, PhysicoUA has a rigorous procedure for comments and reply. And obviously, you are also welcome to contribute if you have ideas in this direction. As a result of our call to the community, there has been also a very nice experiment performed by the Amsterdam group, led by Iannuzzi, It has two features, main features, high statistics and very low drifts. Okay? And the outcome of this experiment can be summarized as follows. I mean, they do not observe anomalous scaling for their order of 100 nanometers spheres. They observe a nice scaling with electrostatic law, but they observe also instead minimizing potential depending on the distance. Okay, a very strong dependence. Look, it's going from order of 100 nanometers, you have minus 4 millivolts, and it's becoming order of minus 12 millivolts in range above 1 micrometer. And also they found that is depending from the run number. Run number means different time. So something is going on. There is maybe also a depends on time. I mean that this V-naught is drifting slowly with time. Okay, so the situation is really complex, more complex than we were expecting. There is also related work you have seen the seminar by Andy Kim, so there is work going on New Haven with semiconductor surface, and then I'm also aware of work performed by George Palazanzas, who was also here in Groningen. We also observed, by the way, time drift. I mean, if you leave the apparatus sitting down nominally at the same distance and you keep going with the automatic procedure to take electrostatic calibration and you plot the electrostatic coefficient versus distance on a time scale of the order of 12 hours, you notice that there are drifts. Presumably these are drifts in the distance, by the way, on 12 hours scale. And from the same data, you can also get an idea of what is going on with the minimizing potential. As you see, you have to assume probably three standard deviations to have a constant V-naught. If you just believe in one standard deviation, there are drifts. Now, are these drifts due to the fact that the distance is constant and really V-naught is changing, or that the distance is changing and since V-naught depends on the distance, then you are changing V-naught accordingly? This is not clear, but it seems that emerging picture is that the minimizing potential is a function of a distance, depends also, and this has been shown to me with an exchange of material by email by George Palazanzas, is locally depending on the surface point, so it depends on X and Y, and probably depends also intrinsically on time. So this suggests that one has to do a more careful in situ and on time characterization of the surfaces. And one other thing which has been probably not emphasized enough is that before taking care of the roughness correction in the Casimir force, we should also take care of the roughness correction in the electrostatic force. Okay? So this, I want to mention this work, which was unnoticed to me at least, but there is a nice discussion on how much is critical the quality of the spherical surface in this determination roughness, for instance. There is a very nice paper. And this shows, in other words, that apparently the sphere plane is a kind of simple geometry, but it has some issues. I mean, a sphere really needs to be an ideal sphere, and apart from Plato, nobody thinks that there are ideal spheres in the world. Okay, so you have to be careful there. Now, I want also to mention a parallel work going on for completely different reasons. I mean, they are studying for the detection of gravitational waves at very low frequency torsional balancing and torsional setups. And in this paper appeared in August of this year, they show that the minimizing potential in a torsional, kind of microscopic balance, torsional balance, is also depending on the distance. Here, as you see, it's microscopic distance, is millimeters. There is a dependence. These are different runs, you see, January, February, and so on, and also depends on time, actually. So because all these plots don't overlap to each other. So you have different drifts of these. And in fact, they were worried about this for the LISA project, because LISA requirement is that the voltage noise in spectral density of the voltage, volt per square root of hertz, should be lower than a given threshold, this dashed line here. And these are the spectra of these versus frequency, then, of this dependence on time for this experimental value. And there is also another insight here in this paper. They measured the surface potential, this minimizing potential, after a processing of the torsional balance, venting to nitrogen, then in atmosphere, pumping back to a decent pressure, and then having also a breakout. And as you see, before the surface potential, before this operation, this period in which we didn't take measurements because it was in air, etc., before there was a given slope for a drift in time of the voltage, and after it became mild. So another warning is that the quality, and this is actually contained, for instance, also in the paper by the Riverside group, a warning about using the better vacuum, because oil contaminant pumps, for instance, or other things that you were discussing can play a role in having these floating surface potentials. And maybe that they also play a role in the first anomaly we have observed.
The point was, it never settles down.
Well, at least doing this processing and with this mild breakout just at 50 Kelvin, the slope you see is milder than before. So before it was changing, the surface potential was changing, you see, of let's say 5 millivolts in about 1 day. After this processing, is changing by half a millivolt in 1 day, roughly.
But
so this suggests that.
Not reversing of what happened before.
No.
So you're baking a surface.
Well, the surface is not. It's not rebaked.
Really it says he does a mild.
There is a bake.
A little bit. Okay, mild baking. Are we to understand that the surface is gradually gathering whatever it gathers?
Yes.
And then if you do something, it gathers more slowly?
Yes. Well, at least you remove the gathering rate. It may be on a scale of weeks. At least in the first week, you have removed most of the junk and it's starting.
There was also something similar said by Sven de Mander, his talk about evaporation of water, water layer.
Well, water, that sounds friendly and mild. This need not be water. So does one go then and bombard the surface with something to see what's on the surface? What does one do to see if the surface is what you think it is?
Yeah, which is part of the problem, yeah.
It could be nanometers thick, it could be micrometers.
Absolutely.
What's here? What did they do after this?
I don't know. I mean, it's the fact is that processing with some mild breakout and also venting and so on changes the slope. This is what you can. I agree with you that this indicates
that. This is the rate of contamination.
Yeah.
Well, it inverts the sign of the surface potentially.
Well, no, the gap is still positive as if it mattered, but. I'm just baffled at the psychology here. You see something wrong, you do something, and it gets worse at a little slower rate. You say, hey, I have to be careful, but you don't look to see what's there.
But to look what is there, you need probably another apparatus. I mean, or at least you have to go.
Yeah,
I mean, it's not something immediate, like to take your apparatus, vent to air, and do a mild breakout and so on. So I agree that then you should characterize, as I mentioned in here, maybe you have to characterize the surfaces. Depending on your application, probably they are happy already with this, and this is just a curiosity to show that processing a little bit more and having some outgassing, fast outgassing going on here, helped them to mitigate the problem. But if you're interested in the real physical problem, you should do systematic measurements and characterize, for instance, also using a gas analyzer, a residual gas analyzer, and so on, so that, yeah, and putting intentionally, you know, some hydrocarbons, for instance, or and see how it's changing with time. This is a, I mean, is a field in itself.
One should do, one should probably spoil the probe, systematically check for that the addition of hydrocarbon.
Yeah.
That's
absolutely. Yeah.
One worry is, of course, the surface charges. Why don't we let you get rid of the surface charges? I mean, basically, that you can use a metal property to get. Get to
shorting them or
no? But not some surface charge sticks to some layer, insulating layer, and cannot be removed. Mm-hmm. So that you have an addition of a Coulomb force on top of
FEM, and so yeah, I think it's going down to almost UHV or UHV vacuum. So if you read his paper published in the spring, in Journal of Physics A, he's also mentioning this issue, and that there is the operating pressure in that paper. So.
So nobody in this business is friends with surface physicists, so they can't go and use somebody's apparatus.
The closest one, I mean, is George Palazantzas. So I don't know if you have spoken.
Open air.
But surface physics, you know, not necessarily vacuum physics, right? Or
no.
Classical vacuum.
Well, I could be friends with all kinds of physicists. I mean, just okay. The guy who has the apparatus.
Yeah.
What is about, I mean, the Amsterdam group told us about this optical radiation errors that are produced if you have a large gap in your ATM. Do you have the same problem, or is it because you have a large surface that you don't have this problem?
No. I think that what we are speaking about is the fact that they use this photodiode.
Yeah.
I mean, they send some light.
Yeah, and it's for large separations, I mean, this arrow becomes. This is one effect.
But the thing is just a pure geometrical effect. These are not thermal photons or whatever. It's just the background of light reflected and going to the photodiode.
It's the spreading of arrows at large separations or at the larger end of the separation.
Yeah.
Do you have the same effect or the same problem or not?
We don't have this issue with the optical fiber because in that case the light is concentrated within the diffraction cone angle of.
Because you measure the distance of the optical fiber.
Yeah. No, they have a deflection. They have a classical deflection, just the reflecting.
Okay.
So
Mardin must have the same problem.
Yes. Yeah. Because it's an they both.
You mentioned. If you this curve that you showed there, that it could be also this effect. If you go three or four slides back, I mean, where you look at this Mardin, one more, this one.
Mm-hmm. In what sense? I mean, apart from the fact that it's difficult, I mean, we have an idea of the scattering of the data here, but there are no error bars here. So it's, you see that there is more spreading here going on than here, but I don't. Obviously, if you increase the distance, you have to apply stronger fields to get the same quality of parabola. Okay? For a targeted deflection, so probably, but this is more a specific question for the investigators. I am not so familiar with their apparatus. I mean, if that scattering is due, but usually, again, if that scattering is just due to this systematic effect, I don't see why it should not be spread out on both sides. Instead, it's going up. I mean, I would expect to be kind of shower.
I think it's
showering.
Going up also in this Amsterdam stuff, as far as I remember.
The B dot?
I mean, this is a clear dependence. I mean, it's depending, it's a strong dependence. I mean, you can discuss about the scattering, but it seems a solid dependence on the distance.
I think we'll have some plenty of time for discussions after we give Onofrio a chance to finish his talk, and then we'll get together for lunch and discussion. So why don't we give him a chance to do all this?
Okay, just five slides.
Okay, good.
So. And okay, so next steps from our side, we want to measure the minimizing potential in the three geometries, because we can do this. I mean, we can also put parallel plates or back the cylinder, cylindrical, and obviously try to attempt to measure the cutting force in the single plate, take into account the space-dependent minimizing potential. If we don't control this minimizing potential modelized, it will be very difficult to get any cutting force, because as I've shown, we have evidence that in the cylinder plane case, the voltage is even more depending on the distance, the minimizing voltage, than in the other two cases. Then, especially stimulated by all the debate I had by email with some people, I want to continue a step two of what I started writing a paper for New Geophysics, invited paper for New Geophysics, meaning I want to go through systematically with all these kind of questions on, through all the experiments and demonstration on Casimir forces, especially with regard to the limits of Eukaryan forces, and without giving anything for granted. Okay, so I'll bother some of my colleagues to give maybe more data, to read the PhD thesis of their students and so on. And obviously I'm also relying on your feedback these 2 days, and on Thursday I can also feedback again on this issue. Well, just a highlight on the case of parallel plates, we put back another surface, plane surface in front of a resonator, and we were able to parallelize to a decent amount, and this is the electrostatic calibration, the typical KL versus VPCT. And this is V naught versus distance, and it's not clear. So we are investigating here if it has a slope or not a slope, and we are getting more data. It seems that it's milder the dependence on the distance if you compare the geometry. Okay, geometry-wise, it seems a flat configuration is less distance dependent. And now, one should not be biased by this, but there is a discussion in the literature of AFM regarding the fact that they can be inhomogeneous. In their case, you have a real tip, so it's a very small radius of curvature, but they can be inhomogeneous electric fields between the tip and the sample. And so if this is true, what we want to test with this measurement and comparing the three geometries more or less in the same apparatus, in the same configuration, same vacuum, same detector, and so on, is to see if curved geometries are more susceptible to inhomogeneities in the local electric fields. Because in this case, it seems that it will be much better to continue experiments in the parallel plates if you shoot for high precision experiment. So this is the last transparency. The acknowledgement will be on Thursday. So I have highlighted some issues of each geometry used for the demonstration experiments on the Casimir effect. The cylinder plane geometry seems promising modulo of this effect of the minimizing potential depending on the distance. To look for the thermal contribution, or in general, Casimir forces at large distance, we have observed the space dependence minimizing potential. They don't coincide then with the contact potential, and there's been a reanalysis of previous results and new experiments triggered by this finding, and it seems that there is a dependence on distance, location, and time. So this has to be scrutinized more. So I want to point out that all these issues on the spherical configuration are only explicit 10 years after the first experiment, or even more, a decade, that the first experiment with sphere plane configuration started. Okay? Only, if you see, many of these issues occurred and are written in papers published during 2008. So there is a decade long period between the first measurement and the appearance of these. And I think that there is only this attempt by Sparnet and then our moderate precision experiment with parallel plates. So my suggestion is, considering the progress in nanotechnology, microtechnology, and so on, to focus a little bit on the attention on parallel plates. And on Thursday, I'll talk a little bit about the dynamical cousin effects, and thanks to your feedback these 2 days, I'll follow up on this material. Thank you.
Lots of questions. I suggest that we get our lunches, and 12:45 we continue in the founders room with further questions.